I was told actually that it was a travesty that the United States didn't score against England. So,
You held them nil-nil. That was a great result.
oh, it's a terrible, embarrassing, honestly.
All right, let's get started. Oh, I'm
Good
gonna have
luck. Good luck picking your cold open.
There's no. Hello and welcome to the American Soccer Analysis Show. I am your host, Kieran, and I am joined by Benjamin Benito Suarez Bellman and Harrison Highlife Crow. Gentlemen, we are out of a heat wave in Reno, Nevada. Harrison, hit us with the Pacific Northwest weather update.
It is sweaty and hot and like nearly intolerable. That's not full out intolerable, but like nearly.
Ben, have you made it out of the heat dome?
Yeah, thank God. We were down to the 80s today. And yes. I walked outside and I was like, this feels hot, but not like I'm going to fall over. So an improvement.
My car AC went out in the midst of a 113 degree Fahrenheit week. It was like driving on the highway, windows and sunroof open with your head out. Kind of move. So, but it's cool now. We got rain. It's great. Toronto Hell is yeah. currently like 6 feet underwater.
I saw that.
It's really bad. So it's better here. It's not better here for one Gregory Berhalter. Mr. Berhalter lost his job after getting grouped at the Copa America. And we thought that it would be fun to talk about me as the lone Canadian at ASA. It would be fun to talk about kind of both of these programs in relation to what is going on for both of them. Obviously, Canada employed Jesse Marsh. There are some people who feel that the U.S. missed out by not hiring Jesse Marsh when he was allegedly approached for the job, and the players were like, we don't want to play for that guy. And we thought it'd be cool to compare and contrast and see the differences between the programs, but also in the lens of international play is weird. And this is an analytically focused podcast. And applying analytics to international football is hard because it's inherently very, very, very small sample sizes.
Noisy.
Super noisy. Super noisy. So I think the best place to start is, let's just put it out there, pro or against moving on from Gregory Berhalter, Ben?
Oh, God. I am so tired of having opinions about this team. It's fine. I guess it's fine. I guess it would have been fine either way. I don't know. I think it's just, like, Kieran, you were talking about how it comes down to a red card. And I think this is where the noise conversation comes in. I'm okay with him being fired, but this is such a dumb reason to fire him. And I think that's where I'm landing on it. It doesn't feel like we have a plan. And I think that's the other thing that's on the back of my mind. I don't know who is the best call to come in 2 years, bring together a talented, but still developing. I mean, this is ideally our core American players hitting their early peak during this tournament. So this is like the beginning of make it or break time for their whole careers, whether it's the World Cup or not. Who is the right person to step in and galvanize them? Because I normally talk very data-y, and like I can't grapple my head around the data in international soccer. I think that's where I am. I think we need a vibes hire, and I think if the players are very against hiring Marsh 2 years ago, not hiring Marsh is the right call.
Well, I think there's no,
you can't do that.
Yeah. He said he is not interested in the job. He's like, I would not be interested in the US job I think his exact words are, I would not be interested unless something significantly structural changed with the US Soccer Federation. And I will say, like, I think he is really enjoying the PR-y aspect of being the Canada coach, where, like, we'll get into this later when we compare and contrast the programs, because I think, like, coaching these two programs right now is actually almost, almost secondarily a coaching job. Almost secondarily. But Harrison, where are you on Mr. Berhalter?
I like Berhalter, I really do, but I understand the need to use this moment to start to find that next bridge. And Ben said it perfectly. There is no plan, and it came down to essentially a red card that, you know, you're saying you're using this as an excuse, and you know, the loud, I don't even know if they're the loud minority at this point in time. I feel like everybody's kind of turned against Berhalter for a variety of reasons, which is really weird because the team still loves him. And I don't understand how the outside can feel so like against him, and yet the inside feels so insulated for him. And it's really weird the way that contrast works. I think it's really hilarious that there are multiple players that didn't want Jesse Marsh, considering like at least half of those have been coached by him at some point in time. I think that kind of should say a lot about his relationship with some of those players. But yeah, man, it's U.S. soccer, especially with the men's team, is so toxic, and the fandom that's related to it, the fandom that's related with international sports in general, is really toxic. We saw this with, you know, the Copa final, and it's just, man, I'm kind of worried about a World Cup in 4 years with this country and just those that are involved. And man, it's just going to be so chaotic, and we're in such a weird place right now as a people. It's just, it's so weird. But getting back to Berhalter, it's fine. Ben said it perfectly. It's fine. You know, I wish they had a plan. I wish we knew where we were going. I think it's hysterical that immediately, like 24 hours later, you had everyone's favorite hire immediately be like, nope, not doing that. So
I'm clubbing in Berlin. I'm busy.
Yeah.
I think
you could actually hear the club noise that like as he's like,
no, I'm just very.
I respect that they were like, hey, any interest? It's like this is a very embarrassing story for me, but I was a very cocky 19, 20 year old. And I remember being out at a restaurant with the single most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life as my server. And I'm with my friends and I'm like, I'm going to give her my phone number. I'm going to see how this goes.
Do it.
She had a ring on. Oh. And I was like, I'm going to give her my phone number because I don't care. I'm that guy. And I left her my phone number, and she turned over the receipt, looked at it, and crumpled it and threw it away. That was the U.S. asking Jurgen Klopp. I think you guys made a couple of really salient points. I think the first off is like, yes, it is vaguely fine. I was probably more pro Berhalter than many, and I feel like before I get into my answer about why I think it's fine, I should explain why that is. To me, the difficult thing with international football is that there are inherently two things you have to consider. One, how good is your talent? And B, how good is the talent you are often going to play? And the reality for the US is that on the global scale, that means at major tournaments, the US has never been better than like the 12th best team. And at a Copa, like the fifth or sixth best team. However, in their federation, you are comfortably the best team, in my opinion. I think now Canada have closed the gap a lot and Mexico are having a down period. But I think in terms of like the pool of players available to you and all of that sort of thing, I think you are comfortably the best team. which Mexico, means
real fast, Mexico gets better by the World Cup, right? Like, there's no way this.
I have no idea. Who knows?
Who knows? I can't even name any good young Mexican players if that aren't American and might choose to play for Mexico.
Okay. Your point.
The difficult thing is that for the U.S., in your federation, the style of play that will maximize in-federation success is very different than the style of play that will maximize tournament success. And the difficult thing to grapple with is that, like, Berhalter has done an unbelievable job of creating a team who defends with the ball, who controls the ball, who is totally in control of all the games they play against teams who are worse than them. You watch the U.S. play basically anybody in CONCACAF that is not Canada or Mexico. And even then, even when they play Mexico, they are so in control of the game defensively. And they create very few, very high quality chances, while the opposition creates few low quality chances. That is exactly how every USA game goes against teams they are better than. The work that goes into building that is borderline antithetical to the work that goes into being a transition mid-block team, which is the route to success when you play someone better than you. And I think Berhalter has done an excellent job of that because the U.S. do not have a team who should be very good at playing with the ball. They have zero midfielders in the entire pool, let alone the players, let alone their, like, first choice best center midfielders who are plus possession midfielders. Like, Weston McKennie does basically nothing with the ball, even though, like, I like Weston. I think he's, like, very athletically talented, which is super useful. I think he's, like,
his skill sets don't align with that.
He's not a possession player.
Yeah, he's great at getting into the box. He's a very good presser, but he's not like, we're going to spray it about. Tyler Adams, who has, like, improved as a possession player, is at best average. Yunus Musah is very good at dribbling in straight lines when nobody is in front of him and basically nothing else. And then you are down to the next tier of, like, what is Tanner Tessman to you? What is Luca Della Torre? What is Johnny? And none of those guys are just even close to Paxton Aronson and Brandon Aronson. Like, none of those guys, until you get to, like, Jack McGlynn is the only plus passer in the pool, and he's not good at anything else. And he's, like, 19. And yeah. So when you say, okay, like, he has built a team who actually are totally in control of games with the ball, that's amazing. That's a huge accomplishment. That has made it so that the U.S. have basically not had a blip against a bad team. They've not had a blip against qualifying for, like, 6 years. Until that Panama game, I could not tell you the last game that, like, the U.S. were, like, other than, like, a friendly against Bosnia. Right? So it's, I think those things are very real to say. Now, I think the reality is it's not like you have some deep-lying midfielder who's 19 years old who in 2 years is going to be ready to start for you. That doesn't exist.
That was 4 years ago.
Yeah. So, like, if the Federation are saying, we don't think we can make a run this way, and we want to do something different, no problems. I don't know if I super agree, but no problems. That's a strategic decision on your part. Totally no problem. I fundamentally disagree with the idea that, like, he has done a bad job and, like, deserves to be fired.
Yeah.
I have no qualms with the idea that he hasn't done enough to be rehired, if that makes sense.
Yes, that totally makes sense.
That's perfect. That is perfect. And I think that aligned with the idea that we said, it's fine. It's a fine move because you're right. He probably hasn't done enough to be rehired.
And I think that goes back to, like, a lot of the decisions about what happened with the World Cup and, like, deciding to go back to him afterwards. I actually think Jesse Marsh would have been, like, a really fun hire for this team because, like, I actually think they should not try and play soccer if they want to do, like, I think it would probably benefit them from, like, a vibes perspective to just, like, we're going to punch you in the face and press and play crazy Red Bull ball. But I don't
know. So what you're telling me is that you want the USSF to hire Ralph Ragnick?
Right. No, no. I mean, you could do worse. You could do worse. You could do a lot
worse. We could do a lot worse.
But that's exactly what the U.S. played for 20 years. And every person complained and yelled and screamed at their TV. And then Berhalter brought it. And they're like, well, that doesn't really align with our player base. And we don't really have the tools for that. He should know. Oh, my God.
So I think one of the really interesting things about this specific U.S. group, and it's very rare, is that the U.S. is basically going to have 8 of 11 starters be the same players for 10 years. Like, other than Tim Ream, basically nobody from this team ages out for the next World Cup and then the next Copa and the next Gold Cup. Like,
Do you think Tim Ream is not on this World Cup team? Because I
No. Ream is definitely on the World Cup team because, like, he's way too good to replace. But, like, he's probably not on the team beyond the World Cup.
Oh yeah, for sure. Probably.
And I think the rare opportunity they have is, like, you actually can install multiple ideas with this team where, like, okay, Berhalter played, like, press and possess and, like, fairly slow and, like, very in control of games. The next person can do something different, but that arrow doesn't leave the quiver. Like, one of the things that I always really liked about Chelsea's, like, constant firing managers thing is that a lot of the building blocks from the prior coaches stuck around, where, like, Thomas Tuchel played a 3-4-3 and a bunch of his key players had come to Chelsea playing a 3-4-3 for Antonio Conte. And in between Antonio Conte and Thomas Tuchel, you have Maurizio Sarri, who plays a very free-flowing possession-style 4-3-3. Frank Lampard plays a rock and roll, like, sometimes 3-4-3, sometimes 4-2-3-1, sometimes 4-3-3, all over the place. And then Tuchel comes in, and it is heavy possession out of a pressing 3-4-3. And it's guys like Rudiger and Azpilicueta and Marcus Alonso and all these guys had built parts of their game and tactical knowledge from, like, okay, I've seen this picture before. And so I think when we're looking at the US, I think they have a very unique opportunity to hire someone who does something different, but who also isn't going to eschew the good work that has been done before. And I think that's a very difficult line to walk.
Do we know if Berhalter's staff is also going, or?
Well, Callahan is in Nashville Callahan's already.
Yep, that's true.
And I
please tell me we're keeping Anthony Hudson.
Yeah, this is the thing, is also, like, who gives a shit about stuff? I would expect whoever comes in will bring their own people. I think it's quite rare that people stick around in international staffs. I know sources say that, like, a lot of people left the U.S. women's staff because they thought Emma Hayes would not give them a fair shake because she was also bringing a lot of her own people.
And that makes sense, just to sort of get ahead of.
Yeah, they were like, this is not, even though USSF were like, your jobs are guaranteed, they were like, this is not going to be what I want.
So I've got a question about this. If I could steal the direction a little bit, because I think you earlier were hinting at almost the most important job is coaching, or maybe it's like coaching and also something. Part of I think what's confusing is you were talking about how much of what an international coach can do is dependent on the talent they have and the talent on the other side of the field. I still feel like there's so much disconnect between the incentives of a coach to win and the incentives of a coach. Like, Berhalter wasn't just hired to win. He was hired to rebuild the whole national program in a way. He was built to identify principles of play that were then going to trickle down all the way to the men's youth teams. You know, I think it was like U20 and up. So, or you even earlier than that. So what do you two think of this tension where you have, ignoring the coach for a second, the Federation is hiring these coaches, but they're also building a national soccer identity and a pipeline to these, you know, keystone national teams on the men's and women's side. How is there conflict in that? Like, how much of the Federation's focus should be on the grassroots and on training the next generation, and how much should be focused on who do we have right now and how do we get the dub?
I think it's a good question because we have been very vocal about coaches should not lead your direction at the club level. And I think one of the really key differences at the club level versus the national level is, like, at the club level, you're there every day. And like, when the coach leaves, everyone is still there. However, in terms of like national technical staff, like, even USSF, like, in terms of full-time national technical staff on the men's side, it's probably like 10 people. So a lot of that stuff is attached to your coach. And I think there are other inherent, like, valuable things. Like, so to loop Canada into this, because I think this is a good place to do it. John Herdman was an at best 5 or 6 out of 10 coach for Canada. The success that John Herdman had with Canada is that he had a very good record of recruiting dual nationals, and that he had a very, 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 very good track record of, like, engaging the team into, like, a culture of Canada soccer, like, where they are traveling with the sword to Panama to place the sword into the pitches. This is our field or whatever. And like, and that's a real story, by the way. They had a sword that they brought with them to away games. And I think stuff like that, like, really matters for, like, I don't know, like, jingoistic nationalism purposes. I don't know, but it's different. It's not, it's borderline not the same sport when you look at a national league play. And one of the things Jesse Marsh has done so well so far is, like, Jesse Marsh, the day after Canada lose the third, fourth place game, is at a CPL game doing sideline interviews, talking about the importance of CPL developing young players to give pathways. The very next day, or no, yesterday, Jesse Marsh is in Montreal giving a press conference at the Impact, or I guess CF Montreal's training center, saying Moise Bombito was not known as a player until he was 23. We need to make sure we're finding the next Bombitos in Quebec at 15 years old. So by the time they're 23, they're already playing for one of the 10 best clubs in the world. And for those who are unaware, Bombito basically, like, bundled it around, like, semi-pro and amateur leagues in Quebec, went to a very mid college and hit, like, a development home run in NCAA before going to Colorado. And the really specifically cool thing about that is the Canadian men's side has basically never engaged with Quebec at all in any way, shape, or form. I cannot recall a coach of ours who has spoken French. Like, Jesse Marsh coached at Montreal already. That was a thing.
Yep.
And I've gotten way off track here, but the point that I'm making is, like, Canada and the US are not England or France or Spain or Germany. Like, it is not just an accepted given that, like, everyone is behind the team to win. Like, this is not a thing. Like, I would say most North American fans actually watch their team with, like, a certain amount of disdain for, like, them not being as good as they want them to be. Where, like, the US were eliminated by Uruguay, and it wasn't people, like, desperately heartbroken that they've been grouped because of an awful red card. It was like, thank God Berhalter's gone. And there is a certain amount of salesmanship required for these jobs, especially in Canada and the US.
Yeah, and to point it back to Berhalter, I mean, that's one of the things that he was really good at, right? You look at all the different dual nationals that we have on this team, and at a certain point in time, there was a question whether Timmy Weah was actually going to play for this team. There was, you know, questions on, you know.
I mean, Pulisic was like could have legitimately chosen Croatia. Like, that was a real thing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Renia.
I think that was before Berhalter, but, like, just as an example.
No, absolutely. And you know, Musa and, you know,
Belogan.
Logan, yeah, absolutely. And who like went to Twitter and like said thank you, coach. You know, he put something out there and thanked him for that. I think that that speaks really highly to the job that he did, right? Not just on the pitch.
I will ever so slightly disagree in that I think Berhalter did a very good job recruiting to Nationals. I think he did a very bad salesman job at large. Though aside, I think Berhalter was like very well liked by the players. I think Berhalter, like in a conversation with a player and their agent and what national team they should choose, would be extremely compelling. Like I think he'd be like, this is exactly how we're going to use you. This is where I see you in my depth chart. This is why I think this makes more sense for you than England or Nigeria. You're going to play right away at 19, Yunus Musa or whatever. And that's part of it. That's 100% part of like a successful version of the job. But I think what Berhalter did a really bad job is like, can you recall a single Berhalter quote that isn't him talking about Gio Reyna at a leadership conference? You recall, like, we because we're sickos in the top 0.001% know like the behind the back passes, but yeah. Like there's no.
I will say I actually really enjoyed whenever he had number one, I always felt candid. Whenever he talked to somebody, I didn't ever feel like he spoke in tons of like wrapped colloquialisms and just ambiguous, you know, hyperbole. I really feel like he kind of told you exactly what was going on and what he was intending to do. And at the same time, it felt heartfelt, it felt honest, and it felt sincere. And I guess that's partly why I liked Berhalter as much, because I don't feel we're ever going to have another coach that's that way. I feel like it's very low probability, right? Because that's just, coaches don't do that, right? Coaches don't come out and talk and say, you know, exactly what's going on with the team and talk about, you know, some of the struggles that they have. They're very guarded with their statements. And I felt like Berhalter wasn't.
Yeah, there's
I will give it to you though. The fact that he lost the fan base so early in his tenure and just continually lost more does speak to his failure as a salesman to rally the fan base around what his ideas were. And I think that's true. I think that's accurate, and that's something I hadn't considered beforehand. And that's a really good point.
Yeah, I think he missed a major stakeholder as one of his audience members. He was like, "What control do the fans have?" And in a way, he's right, but look at
what I mean, he is 100% right.
In a way, but also he was very, very wrong. And what I'm noticing now is Jesse Marsh being very public. Like, so he's going on the tour. He's talking. He's trying to win Canadian fans to his side. And he knows he's got a good moment because Canada just did really well at a tournament.
This is the thing, right? Like, Canada soccer are tremendously in debt. And basically coming fourth in that tournament has almost got them entirely out of debt. Based on the way their bonus agreement works with the players, they were like something like $6 million in debt. They get $8 million for coming fourth. Generally, to go to a tournament like this costs the Federation about $1 million to run the camp for a month. And so like you take away, I think the players get 40% of the bonus is their agreement. So of the $7 million left over, like kind of cut their debt in half. Something like that. And it's a huge moment where like the Federation actually need him to build on that. They just hired the Golf Canada CEO is like the new Canada soccer CEO, and he's doing a really good job so far. But the point about him being very public is very real. Like, this is an anecdote, but is like, I think very apt, is like, after the Panama game, I got a message from someone talking about the Berhalter thing where like they had tweeted something and I DM'd them and I was like, this is crazy. Because what they were saying was like, one of the things that really bothered me is that like they didn't like prepare the players to handle the moment of like playing a CONCACAF opponent like that. And I'm like, well, I don't think that's really fair. But they said the point of like Matt Turner gets clocked. And nobody reacts. None of the staff take a yellow card from the referee to lose their mind, to set the tone about it. nobody, like, there isn't an immediate U.S. reaction with a horror tackle the other way or anything like that. And I'm like, yeah, that's smart. Why would you take a booking? It's already done. However,
well, that's something that they also learned from Mexico, right? Because there was a couple different situations that came from us reacting and overreacting.
Well, so
really punished us.
So I agree with you. I agree with you. But on the flip side, Canada are playing Uruguay in the bronze medal game, and there's like a horror tackle in midfield. And Jesse Marsh is losing his mind on the sideline. And I immediately get a text from my dad with some racial epithets about how South Americans shouldn't be allowed to play soccer, immediately followed by, I love that Marsh is going to bat for his team. But at the same time, like, he's a 60-something white guy with disposable income who's going to go watch the games and is going to go to the games and is going to talk about it with all his friends and is going to, like, write an op-ed to his local paper about how Jesse Marsh is embodying Canadian values like Don Cherry or something. So I think that sort of stuff really matters. I think that stuff really matters.
That's fair. And I will tell you, you know, just kind of like what we talked about beforehand, I don't believe in fans affecting the game, but in the end, like, they cost Greg Berhalter's job, you know, so maybe it is something that we need to think a little bit more about, because obviously they can affect, you know, the federations, and they can impact decision making at that level.
So let's transition somewhere else. Let's transition to one of the things that I quite liked about Berhalter, and I very, very, I adore, truly adore about Jesse Marsh, is that both of these guys were very willing to engage with analytics. And one of the things that's really interesting about international management and international soccer in general is that you are operating on extremely small sample sizes of situations with limited context. So, Ben, I mean, you've worked in a club. I'm going to give you a theoretical scenario here. USSF go to you tomorrow and are like, okay, Ben, we want to do everything you did with the Rapids, but we want to think about how things are different. Where does your brain go immediately from an analyst point of view, from an analytics point of view? What's different? Where does your brain go?
So if we're actually going to look at the analytics, we have to be looking at the club data. I think that's where I go, but I think the difference is now you're at a different counterfactual, which is you're building a team. It's almost like you're playing fantasy. Like, you are literally building a team from a potential pool of players. You can pick any of them they want, and they're going to want to play for you. But you can't, unless they happen to be a dual national, and that brings its whole other, like, complex human question into these types of questions. Like, it's limited. So how do you match skill sets? How do you figure out who's good at what, and are these skill sets going to complement each other, and how do you know that it's going to fit the style you want to play? Because I think more than anything, the biggest challenge of international soccer is get players who are never playing with each other to play together. How do you, and at what corners do you cut? Because you have to cut corners to get there. What corners do you cut? And whether that's a player, whether that's playing time, whether that's, I know you like to take these long shots, don't do that. Or I know you like to make this run, definitely don't do that. I think it's just going to be a bunch of experimenting with, like, figure out what types of players you got and try and mash them together in the models and see what you get.
So this is a perfect place to drop this, because this is going to come out at some point. A tool we've been building in the background at ASA that the pre-alpha version of has dropped to our Discord subscribers. So if you want to get your hands on something like this, the ASA Patreon, $5 a month is where you can find it. We've been building a tool that, and I say we, Matthias has been building a tool, that you can create a lineup. You pick your 11 and 3 subs, and it tries to predict, based on the G+ contributions of those players and how they fit together, based on what we know about how G plus translates to goals and how goals translate to wins, it tries to predict the outcome of games. It is quite good from talking to Matthias behind the scenes. It is, I'll just say it's quite good at not predicting specific results, but like who wins. It's pretty good. And I'm super curious if Sam Gregory, who is now the director of analytics for US soccer, do you, Sam, if you're listening, reach out. Like, do they have a model being like, well, all right, we don't have the time to try 10 lineups. We don't. There's not enough qualifying games. There's not enough friendlies. We can't try this. And when we do try, we have like 30 minutes of sub minutes against in a friendly against Bosnia. Like, that's what we have. I'm very curious how someone like him is approaching like lineup data. Like, how are they informing the coaching staff to be like, yeah, like we know on off doesn't really work in soccer. Like, we know plus minus isn't perfect, even particularly good. I'm very curious how they like, whether they have models like that to project out like, okay, based on all their club performances and how we think this fits together, this is your best 11 and your best three subs. Harrison, for you, how much does something like XG weigh in when you're talking about an at max 7-game tournament?
That's a really good question, because on one hand, you want to look at it on a game by game basis, right? Like, all of us want to turn in and say, well, how did they do? How did they create chances on a consistent basis? The problem with that is on a game by game basis, it's really not very good. It's not very predictive on just a single game, right? I think it's 5 to 10 games is where it actually starts to show some predictability. So at that point in time, really your expected goals for isn't, it's not very good. However, comma, expected goals against, that's kind of the money shot, right? That's where you can start seeing how much you're actually giving up, because that's much more predictable sooner. And so as a result of that, that's kind of what you want to incentivize. And that's why, like you were talking earlier about how important it was to play defensively with the ball against worse teams, and why that's such a good thing for the United States to be doing, especially in what Berhalter did. That's something that's very relatable on an international scale. And it's not just from bad team perspective, but it's also a transferable skill onto much better teams, right? And so that's really what you're looking at from a 5-game tournament. You're looking at how well did we stop chances from becoming real goal scoring opportunities. That's really what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the defensive stuff, because I am Ohm used to call me a football terrorist. Because I am
accurate.
I am a firm believer in like extreme defensive focus and knockout play. And it really comes from like a place of math. Like, if you think about it, if you tie at worst, if you do not concede, so you do not concede any goals, at worst, your probability to advance is 50%.
So
at worst, it cannot be worse than 50%.
So the Sounders really did something to you as a teenager in your formative years. The Sounders,
yeah, really, you know, like, no, but it's true. It's true. I also like Chelsea got drilled in a Champions League final and won the Champions League final with like 4 XG against or something. No, but it's purely like a math thing. Like, if you look at
100%.
Like this was a thing that came out when Chelsea won the Champions League under Tuchel, was like, that team was like just okay going forward, but they were like conceding for a 30 game stretch. Their average XG against was 0.35. They were conceding one shot on net a game. Like, it was obscene. Like, their defensive metrics were they were so good to a point that like, even like people like Kaylee and Goodman were like, this is so good. And even though the data is all there, it's like too good. It's unsustainably good. The same way when like Man City were averaging like 4xG a game. They're like, this won't happen. So, and what a lot of the modeling came out of that was like, actually XGA is much more predictive of two advanced probability and knockout play. And that's why I say when we talk about like Berhalter versus Marsh, like one of the things that really hurt Canada in this tournament was like they were like quite poor defensively. They were actually quite good going forward. They end the tournament with basically a zero XGD over seven games. Like they're roughly they're like minus two versus Argentina, plus one versus Peru, zero versus Chile, plus one versus Venezuela, minus one versus Argentina, and then plus one versus Uruguay to batten down at zero. And the problem they have is like they get drilled because all the chances they concede are in transition, which is like very much a Jesse Marsh thing. And for me, like I like this team and I enjoy that they play quite aggressive. I think it's more fun and it's easier to get behind. And I understand why, like, you see Canada play Uruguay, basically the same Uruguay lineup, and Canada come out and they punch them in the face, and Kone scores a bicycle kick, and they're doing all this crazy stuff, and the game is a track meet. And then you watch the U.S. play Uruguay, and it is, like, very terrible, and you have, like, a weird, insane refereeing decision, and it, like, isn't that fun to watch them create nothing, but also not really give up anything of no. I understand why people feel that way. But I think from an analytics perspective, like focusing on the defensive side at the international level is huge. And like we have seen for all the criticism, like England and France have had a tremendous amount of success being like fairly stodgy defensive teams. Spain 2008 to 2012, everybody thinks of this like wildly free flowing possession attacking team. They win
0-1.
They win every game 1-0 by conceding nothing. So I think it's a very interesting topic.
Well, I mean, this is something that North Americans know intuitively because we have playoffs. Defense wins championships. That's not up for debate. And I assume the reason that's not an idiom anywhere else is because of no playoffs.
So actually, it's funny you mentioned that. There was, I was talking to somebody who does like basketball analytics stuff because Summer League is going on in Vegas right now. And I was like debating whether I was going to go down or not. And historically, that is absolute in basketball, that is absolutely true that if you like, look at championship probability versus defensive ability and offensive ability. The best defenses have like, it has been more valuable than the best offenses. However, in the last like 10 years or so with like the Warriors and like all the 3-point shooting, that has started to skew the other way a little bit. What I would be curious about for soccer is like, I imagine that attacking ideas have gotten so good that like, that same transition might have happened in club soccer. And I think this is going to be this is an important point, is that like in international soccer through a calendar year, you have maybe 20 training days, maybe 20 training days. It is very, very hard to install complex possession ideas. And that is why, like, so many teams just play, like, counter soccer ball in international. Like, that's – if you look at every, like, international team that is ranked, like, 30 to 60 that overperforms their talent, it's playing, like, a 4-4-2 mid-block encountering with two fast guys. Like, that's every team. So I think it's very difficult to make broad analytic assumptions in international play because of the unique context of it. Harrison, I'm curious where you think these two teams are going. Like, are you hopeful as an American? What an existential question.
Well, that's in a larger sense, no. In a very small, very specific, you know, thought process, also no. I think it really depends upon who you hire as a coach. And it comes down to two different things, right? I think you do have to, I don't think you're wrong. I think that the idea of putting someone like Jesse Marsh in charge, somebody that has that really great transition, I think this team could be a really fun track meet type team. I think they have a lot of the pieces. The problem with that is that they have very little good defensive players. They just, their defensive players just aren't. Tim Ream's great. Tim Ream's also like, I think he's old enough to actually be my brother. So, I mean, that's a diss on me for being old, but it's also a diss on him because he's also old. So like, whoever they get and whoever they bring in, they're going to have to figure this relationship out between being more offensive, a little bit more offensive facing, as well as being a little bit more defensive structure as well. And, you know, we saw that in a couple of different games, right? To where their defensive structure just kind of fell apart. And if you really wanted to say and really create a reason for why Berhalter failed at the at Copa, aside from the red card, you could really point to that, right? There's a lot of reasons why they should have been a lot better in the Uruguay game than what they were. So yeah, I think it all depends upon who they get as a coach right now. And I think they need to, yes, that needs to be a coach that's a spokesperson that can bring in, you know, dual nationals and help develop. But this is for 2 years. So realistically, we need a guy that has really concise ideas and ideas that can be deployed in very small turnaround. If we can get that and we can find that, great. I don't know who you're going to get that does that. I'm just not, and I don't say I don't know who's going to get that because I'm like, you know, there's so few options. It's more of I legitimately don't know who you're going to go get that does exactly those things, because I just honestly, I don't know off the top of my head. So I think if you're going for a grocery list, that's kind of the essentials of what you're looking for, right?
Ben, is there anything in the numbers, something about this team analytically that makes you excited moving forward?
I haven't looked at the numbers of this team. I'm not excited about this team. I'm just not. I got no numbers. I got no excitement.
I'll give you a number.
Give me a number, Karen. I'll rate it on an excitement scale.
Of the starting 11, think about how many of those starters are under the age of 24.
I don't know how much hope that gives me.
Pulisic, Reyna, Balogun, Weah, like all those guys, Musa, Dest was injured. Like all those guys, even if we like take the US out of it, it is extremely unlikely that none of the very young and quite good, like in the grand scheme of things, like I've been very critical of Gio Reyna because he seems like an asshole, but like he's a young kid who's like been broadly productive at a decent level at very young ages. Like the odds that he's not quite good at 25 are unlikely. The odds that Pulisic 2 years from now isn't still quite good are unlikely. The odds that Balogun is, like, to me, like you could make a deep run at 2026 and nothing changes purely off of like hitting a couple preferential development outcomes.
I think you just summed it up right now, is this upcoming tournament has actually very little bearing on how good this program is or is going to be 10 years from now. I mean, 10 years from now, most of this crop of players will probably have aged out, but it's something that you have this, like, but they're going to be like 26, 27, 28 en masse. Their backups are going to be younger than them. Are all of their backups going to develop to the level that they need to be? Honestly, in terms of this tournament, I'm more concerned about their age. I think with the number you gave me gives me more hope for 2030 than it does for 2026. If we do anything in 2026, it's going to be purely vibes based.
That's international football, baby. Vibes, yeah, well, and the always. Luck of the draw.
Always. But yeah, I mean, we have some very talented players. I wish more of the players a couple rungs behind them were getting more consistent minutes in MLS as opposed to making, you know, trying to make a roster in Europe and it maybe not getting the time they need. That's where my concern mostly lies. But I think we'll be fine in 2026, and I think we'll be even better in 2030.
Ben, let me ask you, with the fact that this is going to be played mostly in North America, say mostly as if it's like not
entirely North America.
I had forgotten about the game that they're playing in Portugal.
Oh God, but it's not a joke.
Donald Trump sells one game to the UAE. The final is played in Dubai.
I mean, they already did that with three games in South America in 2030, but you know.
Let's
that's
anyway,
oh God, thank you all for
sorry I derailed you.
New nightmare. With that being said, 2026, doesn't this every fan is excited because this is home field advantage for a team that yes is young and yes is growing and developing, but they're one of the more finished and maybe world developed groups that we've ever had. And so as that stands, they feel like this is the best opportunity we're ever going to have to make an impact on a world stage. I know it's crazy. This is
I hear you. It's things people are saying.
Tournaments are stupid. Like I have a thing on Twitter that every once in a while I'll use. Headers are hard because headers just like are low probability for most attacking players and defenders. They go all over, right? Every once in a while you get a Kai Kamara who's just like stupid, insane, really good at them. But overall, headers are hard, right? Tournaments are hard. And regardless of whether or not you have home field advantage, but being that you have home field advantage, does that raise the possibility for Canada, for the United States to do more? And should they expect more
perspective? So Matthias and I have actually done some modeling of this because of gambling reasons, for not this, but for something else. And
I love you guys so much.
Across virtually all sports, so like Olympics, everything, home nations overperform their betting odds like significantly.
We saw that with Russia, right? We saw that with Russia was one specific team that definitely did a whole lot better.
Yeah, I will speak to that firsthand because I was there. That was the most insane environment for any sporting event I have ever been. When they beat Spain in the shootout, I kid you not, this is going to sound like a Bert Kreischer like fake story. People were driving down the street in Moscow, hanging out of the sunroof of a like battered old BMW, shooting, like spraying champagne and vodka on the street at passersby, like honking the horn, like literally like young Russian men hanging out of the roof of their cars, like going crazy. It was unbelievable the amount of like pressure that opposing teams felt. I can imagine. I think when we're talking about the US, I think there might be like a little bit of negative pressure where like that, like they kind of like England, where like if they had a bad half, like I could see them getting booed. I would hope that's not the case, but I imagine that is some of the difficulty of that. But yes, analytically, home nations tend to overperform their betting odds. That is a thing.
And it's why I remember that Brazil-Germany game so vividly.
Well, think there's a lot of examples like South Korea in 2002, like South Africa made it out of their group in 2010, I think. There's a lot of good examples. All right, let's wrap up here. Harrison, give me a name. Who's the next coach of the United States men's national team?
God.
Should this be who we think it is?
Whatever you want. Rapid fire, throw a name.
I
and give me one sentence why you think that's why you think.
I've seen, so I'll just say I've seen the reports of Pooch, and Pudichenko just seems like he might be offered the job, seems like he might be interested in the job.
Ricky Pooch? Is that what you just said?
I said Ricky Pooch.
Yeah.
Oh, Poch. Maurizio Pochettino?
Yes, correct.
That would be a great hire.
I think it would be. I think that he does a lot for.
I thought you said Ricky. I thought you said Pooch. Ricky Pooch. I was like,
yeah, Ricky Pooch. You know, not only has he helped LA get to be tied for first place in the West,
he's also national team manager, and he's defected, so they have one midfielder who can pass.
No. Here's the twist: whole time he goes and plays for Spain in between. Boom!
Incredible.
Mind blown. How about that? Let's get Sean Steffen to write some really good fun stories like that. That would be great. I think Pudicino, he definitely has the with a lot of his Spurs teams early on, they succeeded over what their talent level was.
For sure. Also
did a really good job developing a couple of the young players, giving them a chance to shine and to be, Dele Alli is kind of one of the players that comes to mind. So I think that that's a pretty decent shout. I've seen Jeff Reuter had a name and I can't remember who it is off the top of my head, but I thought that was a really good shout. There's some names.
Poch is your name. Ben, who is your next U.S. National League coach?
I'm going to have to go with Pablo Mastroeni on that one. I think he's a great vibes guy. I don't think we should overthink this. I think having an American coach is a good marketing technique. I'm going to go ahead and say that. I also think that American coaches don't get fair shots in other top jobs. So I think it's okay to prioritize Americans for this one. And I just don't want him to be on RSL anymore. So there's that.
That's fair. I think Poch would be a great. I think there's a 0% chance Poch would do it, but I think that would be a great hire. I don't know how I'd feel about Pablo. The other name that's like been very well reported is Steve Cherundolo. I think he's done like a fairly good job with LAFC, but also like I think he'd be a weird. I don't know why he would leave LAFC, and I think he would be like a weird tactical fit with his like. Sometimes back three, and also like Ilya is the only person I'll play as a DM, and like I don't know.
I mean, I'm sure he's a good coach, but I have no reason to think that he has any skill at picking out of a player pool. I think Pablo could. I think Pablo, by rotating through his lineups, by facing injuries and getting, you know, fitting those pieces together, I think he's shown those skills. But
so I'm going to frame my pick as a question and answer. Who is the only coach in MLS that you can think of who has played with great success and limited, I mean zero input to roster control, who is the only coach who has coached a heavy possession team and a heavy pressing team separately at the same club with the same overall player pool? And he didn't pick the players.
Are you thinking of Ben Olsen?
I was going to say Caleb Porter, but Ben Olsen.
Not thinking of either of those two. I'm thinking of someone who's probably a tier above those guys, who played a diamond with Harris Madunian in as a six.
Jimmy C.
I think Jim Curtin's like the no-brainer hire for the role. Like I can totally see him. He's almost had his contract lapse in Philadelphia multiple times. I can totally see him being willing to walking away, given they won't spend any money. And he has coached extremely aggressive pressing teams. He has coached extremely slow possession teams. He's someone who is clearly open to analytics. He is not old. He has a quite good development track record of being willing to play young players and engage it. Like Kevin Sullivan is going to be in the Philadelphia Union squad this week. He's 14.
Yeah.
I think overall he would be my number one pick by like quite a distance, I think, because I agree with Ben that I wouldn't hire Foreign. I don't think there's anyone if I was getting someone obviously good enough, like Poch, if I could get Poch, I would hire him. But I don't think, and same with Klopp, if I could get Klopp, I would obviously hire Klopp. Graham Potter, I think, would be an excellent hire, but I think it's quite likely he'll take the England job. But like Luis de la Fuente, the Spain coach, was like, I'd be interested in the US job. Like, please give me a new contract. Like, guys like that don't really excite me. But yeah, Jim Curtin would be my guy. All right, we're gonna wrap up there. Thank you all for listening. Actually, I'm gonna say one thing because I want to talk about this for 2 seconds because it pisses me off. Argentina won the Copa America and immediately took to Instagram to sing the most vile racist song about the French national team, where the lyrics are related to their African heritage and that they're not actually French. And at the center of this is Enzo Fernandez, who was the one running the Instagram live. And now all the Chelsea players are really mad at him and are like unfollowing his Instagram and stuff. And this is in relation to the gong show that was Copa America at large. Moise Bombido got drilled with racist abuse the whole tournament because he tackled Messi. I'm extremely tired of this shit. And I know that 2026 is going to be so bad for stuff like this. And I just really hope it's not. So that's all I'm going to say about it. It really pisses me off, though. And I'll be at Chelsea Wrexham in a few weeks, and if Enzo is there, I might yell mean things at him. So that's it. That's all from us. No trivia today. As always, if you want to support the show, if you want to support ASA, we have a Patreon. It's $5 a month. There's one tier. It gets you access to a Discord. Like I said, there's like alpha features go in there that you can test out and have fun with. People have been playing around with the lineup builder. I made Charlotte have Alisson and Mbappe, and they were projected to win the East, which I think is pretty accurate. So yeah, if you want to support us, another one, the expected own goals guys, they are doing bonus episodes for the Olympics. I believe they're also doing live watch alongs. They just dropped the Patreon. So if you've been really enjoying the women's soccer side of things, go check that out. They dropped the details on their latest episode. That's it. That's it. Keep watching the soccer. Leagues Cup is coming up. I think the All-Star Games coming up. The Olympics is coming up.
The Rocky Mountain Cup.
The summer of soccer. It's in full swing. So that's it. As always, enjoy the soccer.